Morning. My name is Jeff Handelman from the firm of Brinkshofer, Gilson & Leone, and we are representing the appellant, the National Spiritual Assembly. This appeal arises from a civil contempt proceeding. The case has to do with who is bound by an injunction once an injunction is issued. And more specifically, the case has to do with when an injunction issues against a corporation, what is the effect of that injunction after the corporation ceases to exist? And we would first like to address why the lower court committed legal error in failing to find the alleged contemptors Frank Schlatter, Joel Marangella, and the PNBC bound, and then turn to why the lower court erred in concluding that the second group of alleged contemptors, SIBC and BPUPC, are not bound. The first legal error to be addressed concerns legal identity. In particular, the lower court committed legal error in failing to find that the alleged contemptors, Schlatter and Marangella, were legally identified with the corporate defendant, the UHG. The lower court determined as a matter of law that legal identity cannot provide a basis for holding a non-party bound by an injunction. And in particular, at page 18 of the lower court opinion, the court squarely addressed this legal issue, and I'm quoting from the court's opinion. The court sees no reason why a non-party's substantial responsibilities in a corporation, combined with a key role in the corporation's participation in the injunction proceedings, would render the non-party directly subject to the court's order. And the lower court spoke in terms of adjudicative authority. It said, and I quote, "These factors, no matter their weight, do not speak to the limits of a court's adjudicative authority." Now, the principle we are here advancing today has been adopted by other courts of appeals, and that is that while the general rule is that a non-party cannot be bound by an injunction issued in a case in which it wasn't named as a party, there's an important exception to that general rule, and that is a non-party is bound by an injunction if he is legally identified with the defendant corporation.
Do you know of any case involving that particular rule that you've enunciated that wasn't a civil rights case?
Your Honor, there are a couple cases on point. The Federal Circuit in Additive Controls addressed this question of what do you do in applying an injunction when the corporate defendant has been dissolved.
That had to do with a patent infringement case?
That is correct.
Other than a patent infringement case, then, do you have anything besides civil rights cases that involve the theory that you've just enunciated?
The two cases we rely on, one is a patent infringement case, Additive yes. Controls. The other one is a trademark infringement case.
Also from the circuit?
That is from the First Circuit.
First Circuit.
Correct. And but these both of these cases draw on, first of all, the fact that Rule 65D codified the common law in this regard. And so Justice Jackson in the Regal Knitwear case summarized Rule 65D, quote, is derived from the common law doctrine that a decree of injunction not only binds the party's defendant, but also those identified with them in interest.
Let me intrude myself again. Was the original injunction a consent decree or was it a fought out battle?
No, the scenario leading to the injunction,
all I ask is a very simple question. Did Judge Austin formulate this decree himself, or was it a consent decree?
It was not a consent decree. There were findings of fact and conclusions of law that
based on a contested argument and presentation of evidence before Judge Austin.
My understanding is that the
See, you weren't around in those days. I was.
But, Your Honor, Judge Austin, bear in mind, this was the counterclaim. The original claim was against the NSA. The trademark infringement claim was brought by way of a counterclaim. So they started it. We responded. And there was a findings of fact and conclusions of law entered by Judge Aspin.
After a hearing.
I do not know if there was testimony at the hearing. I do not believe there was testimony given at the hearing by both sides, but Judge Austin...
Well, what was the predicate for the decision then?
The
stipulation of facts?
No, there was no stipulation.
How did you arrive at a decree at all?
I believe the NSA submitted, appeared at the hearing and presented Judge Austin. I don't know if there was live testimony at the hearing or not, but presented evidence on which the findings and conclusions were based.
What evidence did they, and how did they present it?
Well, for example, the deposition of the chairman of the UHG was taken and submitted to the court. So we have the deposition.
Accepted by both sides is factually true?
The testimony was sworn deposition testimony of the chairman. And that was
swearing testimony in each side of your case normally, but I want to know, how did Judge Austin arrive at the conclusion if there was no presentation of live witnesses? Was it a stipulation of facts?
I do not believe it was a stipulation, Your Honor. We can look into whether
it was a contested question of fact, and he made a resolution based on affidavits?
Your Honor, if I could look into that and get back to you, I would prefer to do that rather than speculate. Thank you.
I have no idea how the decree came to be. That's my problem.
Okay.
Do you know whether the constitutionality of issuing such an injunction was litigated, given the religious context?
Yeah, I believe Judge Austin made explicit findings that the trademark laws apply equally to religious organizations and commercial organizations, and that this case involved a blatant infringement of trademark rights that were recognized under federal law.
Because the legal landscape in this area, of course, has changed since then. We're talking about an injunction that was issued 40 years ago, and the Supreme Court, in the meantime, has issued the Presbyterian Church case that talks about the principles, the neutral principles doctrine that needs to be applied in this context. And, of course, that case wasn't on the books at the time.
That is correct, Your Honor. With respect to, first of all, the validity of the trademark and the finding of infringement, those issues are not open to be retried in the context of a contempt proceeding as a prefatory matter. But beyond that, the law is well settled that religious organizations, as I mentioned, are entitled to the protection of the trademark laws, and in this case...
But they're not entitled to a judicial declaration that their church is the one true church, and that's what Judge Austin said.
Well, if Your Honor, in the context of a religious organization case under the Lanham Act, a mark is valid. There's no per se rule against trademark protection in the religious organization context. What you look at is whether the mark in question signifies affiliation or membership with a single organization. And in this case, the National Spiritual Assembly has a three-tiered administrative structure as is laid out in the briefs. You have the Universal House of Justice at the highest level. You have the National Spiritual Assemblies at the intermediate level, of which there are 183 worldwide. And then you have the local spiritual assemblies. The Baha'i mark is federally registered, is extensively used, was federally registered at the time of the original injunction, and it signifies members who are affiliated with national spiritual assemblies authorized by the Universal House of Justice in Haifa. Now, what's happening in this case is the alleged contemptors are, through their websites, calling themselves the official, in one case, the SIBC has a website where it calls itself the official Universal House of Justice. And as a result, prospective members are going to that site thinking they're contacting our client, the Universal House of Justice in Haifa, Israel, when they're not. They're also believing that the content on the site is approved by the Universal House of Justice when it is not. And this is precisely the harm that the Lanham Act is intended to prevent. And Professor McCarthy, in his treatise, recognizes as much. And if I could quote briefly, if a parent religious society remains true to the tenets of the religion, it is entitled to protection against a minority's use of the same name. For example, a preliminary injunction can be obtained by the mother church against a local which is disaffiliated because it stops paying to the mother church. And the rationale makes sense, because without a preliminary injunction, the mother church's reputation would be outside
its
control.
Who are you quoting at the moment?
Professor McCarthy, his treatise on trademarks and unfair competition. So he's recognizing...
Well, he's recognizing that the Supreme Court is more significant than Perez McCarthy, I would suspect, wouldn't you?
But the point is that this case does not call upon this court to evaluate religious doctrine. It calls upon this court to apply the Lanham Act to religious organizations, which has been done before.
Well, to the extent that you're reading the injunction as prohibiting anyone other than the NSA from using the word Baha'i in the title of the religious organization's name, that clearly raises some constitutional concerns. Is that how you're reading the injunction? That you have exclusive, your client has exclusive rights to the term Baha'i, and no schismatic organization, schismatic group, breakaway group can ever use it into perpetuity in the United States?
As long as the trademark rights are valid and federally registered and not abandoned, that is correct.
That's the word Baha'i. So to use a hypothetical, someone could copyright Christianity. Somebody could copyright Judaism. And that would prohibit anybody else from using that terminology in the title of their religious organization.
No, each religious name or
trademark.
Yeah, each religious name or mark has to be evaluated on its own merits. There is no blanket.
What's the response to the hypothetical, though?
The hypothetical is, yes, a splinter group that is not affiliated with the National Spiritual Assembly authorized by the Universal House of Justice is not permitted to use the term Baha'i in a way where it is holding itself out as being affiliated with the group headed by and authorized by the Universal House of Justice.
Well, that's different. So they can use the word Baha'i in the name of their new church. They just can't use it in a way that implies affiliation with the mother church.
That is correct. They cannot confuse the public into believing that they are affiliated with the mother church when they're not, particularly whereas here their doctrines in many cases are antithetical to that those espoused by the mother church.
What could they call themselves and escape liability for contempt?
They would have to use a non-confusingly similar name because they are not...
They could use the word Baha'i.
It would depend on, not if it suggested affiliation with the
mother
church.
How about a Reformed Baha'i? Do they use that term?
That would be a hypothetical. If the use suggested affiliation or connection.
I just gave it to you. Reformed Baha'i.
No, that under the injunction, that would be prohibited. The injunction,
I read the injunction.
Yeah. And the injunction.
I just didn't know how it came to be, but you're going to enlighten me on that subject. So.
So the injunction would prohibit a use likely to cause confusion as to affiliation. So if we could also, Your Honor, continue with the legal error. So number one, the court failed to identify legal identity as a basis for privity, although that has been recognized by other circuits and it stems from Rule 65D itself. The court further erred in failing to recognize that the injunction has effect after dissolution of the corporate entity. In effect, the court held that because the UHJ dissolved, the effectiveness of the injunction lapsed and could not continue.
Asking us to adopt essentially the analysis of the Miriam case from the First Circuit?
Miriam as well as Additive Controls. In both of those cases, the Court of Appeals, for example, in Additive Controls, the alleged contemptor Cotton was found liable, and the court stated his liability stems from the district court's finding that he was legally identified with ADCON. And under that theory of liability, the alleged contemptor Cotton was bound by the injunction against ADCON just as if it had been directed against him personally. And the fact that ADCON was no longer carrying on business didn't cause the injunction to lapse. And that's exactly what Miriam held. In Miriam, the court likewise said that if we find the alleged contemptor George Hoskins to be legally identified with the corporate defendant, then when the injunction was issued, and if so, then for that reason he continued to be subject to the injunction even after Webster Dictionary, the corporate defendant, went out of existence. So that's the analytical framework that we are suggesting this court adopt. It's been adopted by other courts of appeals. It's based on the Supreme Court authority interpreting Rule 65, and we're aware of no cases not following that line of authority.
And as applied here, that means that Schlatter and is it Marangella or Marangella?
Marangella.
Jella are such key control persons, you would argue that their breakaway group that they founded is bound.
That is
as
correct.
Well as them personally.
That is correct.
By the dissolution of the enjoined party.
Because the organization, the PNBC, is acting in concert with both Schlatter and Marangella, and therefore the organization is bound.
And how would that principle then apply to the Jensen breakaway group? Because he disassociated himself with the enjoined party before the injunction was issued, as I recall the actual findings.
And in concluding the first remarks, with respect to the second group of alleged contemptors, two bases for finding them bound. The first is based on the admissions they made in their Patent and Trademark Office filings that both groups were legal successors to Mason Remy with respect to the trademarks that they were applying to register. And because Mason Remy was the head of the UHG at the time the injunction was entered, he is legally identified with the UHG, and therefore the legal successorship flows from Remy to both SIBC and BPUPC. The court failed to recognize the legal significance of those admissions. The court made a finding of fact in the opinion that in the applications, and both parties made the admissions of successorship. And if I could just quote briefly from the court's opinion, Neil Chase, the current president of both SIBC and BPUPC, filed and signed these trademark applications, which stated, among other things, that BPUPC and SIBC are legal successors to Mason Remy, citing to the record. The A sites are A422 and A443. Now, the legal error the court made is in failing to give those admissions appropriate legal significance, because she failed to recognize Remy was legally identified with the UHG, so she repeated the same legal error there.
You're and in then, your rebuttal time. You
thank
know.
You, Your Honor. I'll reserve the remaining time.
Mr. McClyman?
May it please the court, my name is James McClymans, and I, together with co-counsel Jim Slowakowski, represent the Orthodox Baha'i faith, namely Franklin Schlatter, Joel Marangella, and the Provisional National Baha'i Council. You asked a question earlier about whether or not the court below had the power to basically declare the practice of Baha'ism illegal. I would contend that, in fact, the court not only didn't have that power, but didn't in this case.
How do we get at that issue, or state it differently? Can we get at that issue? This is a contempt proceeding, and the general rule is you can't collaterally attack the injunction in a contempt.
Certainly,
proceeding.
If we were a named party, that would be true. I haven't seen any authority that says that we can't attack the injunction when we're not a named party. It hasn't been determined yet that we're in privity with a named party. That would put us in an almost impossible situation, frankly. So we could get an illegal injunction, say, on default, saying that, like, for example, a restrictive covenant in a deed is legal, a restrictive covenant based on race, for example, and then go against another party and say, you're conducting the same enjoined activity, but you can't argue that this is an illegal, injunction because you can't challenge the validity of the injunction in a contempt proceeding. So,
but it's all based on this fiction that you've had your day in court if you're in privity.
Exactly. But I think it's important to look at the underlying. The question is whether or not there's a substantial continuation from the National Assembly on the hereditary guardianship and the Orthodox Baha'i faith. And it's improper to look, I believe, at religious doctrine as a basis for finding such a substantial continuation. The issue before the court in 1966 was a property dispute. It was a dispute between two entities that had virtually identical names. You had the National Spiritual Assembly of the United States. You had the National Spiritual Assembly under the Hereditary Guardian. They were both claiming title to the properties of the Baha'i faith. That was what it was about. So what the court
It's not an identification problem. Then it had to do with specific...
Well, that was what the underlying suit was, and then the countersuit was an identification problem. You had confusing names, right? They were both the same name, in essence. So what the court below, when it concluded that UHG didn't have title of the property, it certainly had the power to enjoin the UHG from claiming title of the property. It certainly had the power to enjoin it from confusing itself with the National Spiritual Assembly of the United States. It actually, in fact, said that the practice of non-NSA versions of Baha'ism were allowed. It said that UHG's Baha'is could organize and practice their religions as they saw fit. So at most, the court enjoined, as I say, a confusion. It resolved a property dispute. It enjoined a confusion between two organizations that were basically vying for the same property. With respect to the legal identity test, it is true that Judge St. Eve rejected the Miriam test as good law in the circuit. I think there's probably some benefit to her decision. It's a bright-line test that clearly respects the corporate form as well as due process. She basically said, as long as you're acting as an officer of a corporation, you can't be hauled into court or bound by an injunction simply because you participated in the litigation. You would need to actually have your day in court. So her disagreement with Miriam appears to be a degree. She says you have to have your actual day. Miriam says so long as it can fairly be said that you had your day in court, then you could be bound. But I don't think the court needs to actually decide the question whether or not Judge St. Eve was correct here, because even under Miriam, this record does not support a prima facie showing that either Frank Schlatter or Joel Marangella were so involved in the litigation that it could fairly be said that they had their day in court. The record clearly reflects that all corporate formalities were always followed throughout the whole litigation period. Both Mr. Schlatter's and Mr. Marangella's roles, to the extent that they did get involved in the litigation, was completely consistent with their roles, their respective roles, Frank Schlatter as a secretary of the corporation, corresponding with the leader of the UHG, Joel Marangella, corresponding back to the UHD on behalf of Mason Remy. So it was completely consistent with their corporate roles. Plus, the court below made no finding of that in any way was the UHG an alter ego of either Mr. Schlatter or Mr. Marangella. Miriam makes clear that the theory of liability that it is espousing is essentially a piercing of the corporate veil type theory. The corporate officer has to have abused the corporate form to such a degree that it can fairly be said that the corporate officer was the corporation. And there's absolutely no finding in this case that either Mr. Schlatter nor Mr. Marangella engaged in such activities. Plus, there's no finding of the high degree of practical control, discretion, or responsibility over either the Universal House, I'm sorry, the NSA under the Hereditary Guardianship, or over the litigation. In fact, Frank Schlatter and Joel Marangella had no control over, personal control over the litigation, and it was, in fact, the court found, powerless over the key decision to terminate the litigation and to dissolve the corporation. So I don't think it can fairly be said that either Frank Schlatter or Joel Marangella fall within the Miriam rule.
Well, those decisions were made after the injunction was issued, though, right?
The decision to dissolve?
Right.
Well, certainly, but, you know, the NSA and the Hereditary Guardianship had just received an injunction that prohibited them from being the NSA. They'd lost their lawsuit. So they complied. They dissolved. And they dissolved at the sole determination of the leader, the ultimate authority of the UHG, which was Mason Remy at that time, as the guardian.
My only point is that that doesn't tell us a whole lot about what their level of involvement in the injunction litigation before the injunction was issued might have been.
Well, it's, I believe it was the opposing side's burden to prove what the level of it was. And as I say, I think the record fairly reflects that the documentary evidence, the testimony of Frank Schlatter, clearly reflects that he wasn't, in fact, running the litigation. He wasn't personally involved in making the decisions about the litigation. He was assisting the litigation. He helped prepare depositions. He did all the things that a corporate officer would do to assist a corporation in prosecuting a case. And if that's all it takes to then be personally bound by a judgment that's resulting therefrom, then I think they're going to have to rewrite corporate shield law. I think everybody understands that if you're working on behalf of a corporation in prosecuting a case, that you're not going to be personally bound by that judgment solely by virtue of the fact that you are a corporate officer or an advisor to a corporation like an attorney.
As far as Baha'ism that you referred to, I guess is that a generic term now that people use who share that faith?
Well, there was authority from New York State that concluded that Baha'ism was a generic term even before this judgment was entered in 1966. That's the I forgot the name of the case, but I've cited it in my briefs. But yes, it's a generic term. It refers to the followers of Baha'u'llah. Baha'u'llah is the founder of the Baha'i faith. He was a Persian who lived in Persia in the mid-1800s.
But it seems the whole argument is over succession. And it seems that as time goes on, there are people who are going to dispute who's the valid successor, et cetera, and they're going to branch off. At this juncture, I assume there are other derivatives.
But that's right. Well, you have the
ones that are here,
co-parties on this side. You have the followers of Jacques Chogomonian, who claims to be a successor to the guardianship after Donald Harvey. So yes, there are a number of different sects of the Baha'i religion. Whether the NSA likes it or not, they say, well, they're the one true faith, and they point to their own international leadership in Haifa as being the source of that authority. But that's their opinion. Last time I checked, the United States, we have the right to practice our own religion and decide what we will as to who we think the true faith is.
Read the injunction as prohibiting any use of the word Baha'i?
I think it could be read that way, and that's what terrified the remnants of the UHG after they dissolved. But I also think it can be fairly said that it has to be read in context. It has to be read in the context of what the power that the court in 96 had, which was to prevent two rival organizations from basically confusing themselves. And not even the NSA's own witness could identify anything on the Orthodox Baha'i websites that suggested that we were holding ourselves out as the NSA, or even that we're holding ourselves out as the Universal House of Justice in Haifa. My time is up, and I don't want to take the other side's time, so can I quickly conclude? Because the district court committed no clear error in its factual determination, the Orthodox Baha'i faith is not in privy with the Universal NSA under the hereditary guardianship. We respectfully request that this court affirm the decision below. Thank you.
Mr. Bauer.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court, Al Bauer, here today on behalf of the Second International Baha'i Council and also on behalf of Baha'i's publishing under the provisions of the covenant. Now, through these contempt proceedings, the NSA seeks to do an end run around current legal principles and legal principles in effect today and the past 40 years of legal precedent. The district court issued a thorough and decisive ruling rejecting the NSA's privity claims and finding as both a matter of fact and a matter of law that neither SIBC nor BPUPC were bound by the terms of the injunction or could be held in contempt.
I have trouble with some of these
acronyms,
but these are the Jensen.
These are the Jensen-related
entities. Okay.
Jensen founded both SIBC and BPUPC. Now, the district court's decision was based on clear findings of fact that demonstrated that neither SIBC nor BPUPC were in privity with the UHG or anyone else bound by the injunction. Unhappy with the district court's findings of fact, the NSA seeks to retry those same facts on appeal. This, of course, goes well beyond this court's scope of review of the district court's decision. This court reviews the district court's findings of fact for clear error or abuse of discretion, not de novo. As it did at the district court, the NSA again argues that SIBC and BPUPC are bound by the injunction through two individuals, Mason Remy and Leland Jensen. The district court rejected the NSA's arguments and held that neither SIBC or BPUPC are in contempt. Today, we ask this court to affirm the district court's decision for the following four reasons. First, neither SIBC nor BPUPC are successors in interest to Mason Remy. Second, even assuming SIBC and BPUPC could be shown to be successors to Remy, this alone is not enough to hold them in contempt or bound by the injunction. Third, the district court properly found that Leland Jensen was never bound by the injunction. The district court found, as a matter of fact, that Jensen disassociated from the UHG in May of 1964. Now, this was months before the UHG even decided to file the lawsuit that led to the injunction, and it was years before the injunction was issued. Finally, even assuming that Jensen remained associated with the UHG in some capacity at the time the injunction issued in 1966, Jensen was not bound by the injunction when he founded BPUPC in 1969 or when he founded SIBC in 1991. SIBC and BPUPC are not successors in interest to Mason Remy.
He did not, he was not on the board and did not participate in the injunction litigation, as I understand the facts. Is that correct?
Jensen did not, no, Your Honor. He was never a member of the UHG board when they voted to proceed with the lawsuit. He was never a member of the board while the lawsuit was pending. Now, there's no legal link between Remy, turning back to Remy, and SIBC or BPUPC. Remy was not a founder, incorporator, officer, or director of either organization. Frankly, he had no role in either organization.
Oh, apparently his son did. Is that right?
Your Honor, his son did have some small role, and his son is also in the chain of religious successorship that Neil Chase traces from the founder of the Baha'i Faith to Mr. Chase. SIBC wasn't even founded until 16 years after Remy had died, which I think conclusively establishes that Remy had no role in that organization. Now, SIBC and BPUPC weren't tools through which Remy sought to evade this injunction either. Again, he had no role in the organizations, and importantly, he appointed other people as his successors, appointing Joe Marangella and then later appointing Donald Harvey to succeed him as the guardian, and also directing the Second International Council under the guardian to continue the work of the UHG. Now, none of these individuals or this organization have any connection to SIBC or BPUPC. Finally, there's no evidence that Remy or the UHG transferred any part of the UHG business or any UHG property to SIBC or BPUPC. And under the Webster case, a transfer of the business is required, in addition to successorship, to hold a non-party bound by an injunction. Now, the NSA relies solely on statements made in the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office documents to claim that SIBC and BPUPC are successors in interest to Remy. Now, in those documents, Chase effectively outlined what he believed to be chains of successorship. The legal chain of successorship that Chase outlined did not include Mason Remy or the UHG. The chain of religious successorship essentially traced the lineage of the guardian of the Baha'i faith, as Chase believed it. The guardian ascended from Baha'u'llah, the founder, to Abdul Aha, Mason Remy, Pepe Remy, and ultimately to Neil Chase. Now, these statements in the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, we contend, don't admit successorship. But in any event, the district court found that these were not binding judicial admissions, but rather statements, evidentiary admissions, that the court was free to weigh according to its judgment. Now, after weighing these statements and all of the other evidence in the case, the district court concluded that neither SIBC nor BPUPC was a successor in interest to the UHG, the only party named in the injunction. Now, I want to return to the fact that even if they could show that successorship, or even if NSA could establish successorship to Ramey, that's not enough to demonstrate that we're bound by the injunction. Again, as the court in Webster explained, which is the case that the NSA relies on, there must be a transfer of the UHG's business or part of the UHG's business to SIBC or BPUPC. Now, there's no evidence that the UHG business or in fact, any UHG property was transferred to SIBC or BPUPC.
Is that a fixed requirement in the Merriam analysis? I'm not sure I read that case that way.
Your Honor, I do think that it's a requirement. It's at least dicta in that case specifically says that there must be a transfer of the business or a part of the business to the non-party.
That wasn't part of the fact pattern in that case. As I understand it, the Merriam company was seeking to bind as a non-party in privity. Had started a new company, but it didn't take the assets of the old company that had been bound. Or am I misstating the facts of that case?
I don't believe that there was evidence in the record at that time, and I think it was being remanded, if I remember correctly, back to the district court to make new to make the appropriate findings of fact. I'm maybe mistaken on that. And as this court has said, that when you have a new corporation formed after the dissolution of the enjoined party, it must be shown that the new corporation was formed essentially to carry out the enjoined activity. Now, again, there's no evidence that SIBC or BPUPC were formed essentially to carry out the activities of the UHG. These organizations had different purposes. The UHG served as the administrative body for the Baha'i faith. Second International Baha'i Council serves as an appellate court for all. It's an international body, so any international disputes can be resolved by SIBC. And BPUPC was simply a publishing trust. Now, the district court also held that properly that Jensen was never bound by the injunction. As the district court found, the evidence overwhelmingly demonstrated, not just demonstrated, but overwhelmingly demonstrated that Jensen disassociated from the UHG in May of 1964. Schlatter testified that the UHG board first decided to go forward with this lawsuit in July of 64, so Jensen was disassociated before they even decided to file the lawsuit and years before the injunction was issued. Now, finally, I want to say that even if the NSA could show that Jensen was somehow loosely associated or affiliated with the UHG when the injunction issued, he was not bound when he founded SIBC or BPUPC. First, he founded these organizations years and decades after the UHG dissolved. He wasn't personally bound by the injunction. He didn't. The NSA has never even alleged that he participated in the legal proceedings or exercised any control over the legal proceedings that led to the injunction. And he wasn't acting pursuant to his association with the UHG when he founded these two organizations. So based on these grounds, we ask that this court affirm the district court's decision.
Mr. Hanneman, you have 2 minutes left.
Very quickly, first, Judge Bauer, I've had my recollection refreshed with respect to the proceedings below, and in fact, the NSA did call a witness before Judge Austin, Mr. David Ruhe, R-U-H-E, who was the Secretary General of the NSA. Evidence and testimony were submitted through him. Judge Austin questioned the witness. The UHG did not appear at the hearing, unexplained. Judge Austin went ahead with the evidence, entered his final judgment, and no appeal was taken. With respect to legal identity, very quickly, those are agreed facts. If you look, for example, at agreed fact paragraph 44 at A530, Franklin Schlatter was an officer and was actively involved with and participated in the activities of the UHG and its legal committee prior to and at the time of the issuance of the injunction. Agreed fact. Likewise, with respect to Marangella, the lower court itself held that Marangella actively participated in the UHG and in the underlying litigation. So we submit that there's no issue with respect to the facts of legal identity. The legal error was the court did not recognize the doctrine and didn't even reach, therefore, whether Marangella and Schlatter were legally identified. Had the court done so, the evidence would have supported that finding. I want to reiterate at the position we're in now, an appeal from a contempt proceeding, we cannot reopen the merits of the underlying judgment. So the review is very limited. It's with respect to privity, i.e. legal identity, and violation of the injunction. And furthermore, with respect to the Supreme Court precedent, I want to emphasize that even if the court could reopen the merits, that neutral principles can be applied to decide the underlying trademark issues, and that and so that there's no constitutional obstacle to the court's affirming the judgment of Judge Austin. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Handelman. And our thanks to all counsel for a well-argued case. The case is taken under advisement.